Our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in the Lehigh Valley. And my guest, Edward S. Henning, is going to tell us about the different products in the grounds of the Lehigh Valley, the minerals that we find there. Ed Henning, I should say right away that I'm John Pierce, your host on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and running the board for us this evening is Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations. My guest, Edward Henning, after formal retirement, pursued his informal academic bucket list dealing with, get this one, archaeology, geology, mineralogy, and paleontology, his longtime passions. Ed, are you able to define all those ologies?
I think so, John.
Let's give a shout out to your wife while we're at it, because she says something about your ologies.
Oh, she says maybe I should have just taken psychology as opposed to the rest of the ologies.
So, and her name is Millie?
Millie.
All right. Good for her. Now, Ed Henning became an advisor to the Honorable Chief Robert Red Hawk Ruth, Chief of Lenape Nation in Pennsylvania. That would be an interesting topic in itself, Ed, which we probably don't have time to cover today. I have not known anybody who advised a chief like Red Hawk Ruth before.
John, Chief Bob asked me to explore the sacred sites of the Lenape. They were called churches in the woods. And my job was to review all archaeology that came into them and do one thing, and that was get the first archaeological site that had artifacts and sacred monuments. And it was done at Scott Run.
What years are we talking about?
This is, 3 years ago. It's the first one that the state of Pennsylvania approved in archaeology.
Well, not only has Ed Henning done that work, but he has also done work with the Siegel Museum in Easton, which is the Northampton County Historical and Genealogical Society. Ed, I've always said that what a good thing to call it simply the Siegel Museum, because the other title is so long, people can't remember it. And he has advised over there. He's given talks there. In fact, that's how I ran onto Ed Henning, attended a talk that he gave on our topic this evening, the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in the Lehigh Valley. He also teaches at Northampton Community College. And Ed, you are teaching this semester this very course on the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution.
That's correct, John, yes.
In the Lehigh Valley. You're working as an advisor and presenter at the National Museum of Industrial History, an affiliate of the Smithsonian in Bethlehem. And your presentation on the iron industry was at the Industrial Revolution's ribbon-cutting ceremony and was submitted to how many syndicated newspapers?
20,500 worldwide.
Oh, wow. That was an honor. You have published over 40 articles on archaeology, geology, mineralogy, and paleontology, 6 CD productions for the Siegel Museum in Easton, and 6 CDs were produced for the Lenape Historical Archives and approved by the Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania for cultural presentations. You've also assisted with a Temple University on 6 formal digs in archaeology, and you've supported Lafayette College's geology mineralogy students. So, Ed Henning, when I asked you if you would like to come on to Lehigh Valley Discourse and tell us about the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, you said to me, I have about 40 topics that I could tackle. We're not going to have time for all of those tonight, but it's going to be a really interesting chat we're going to have here. Ed was the first archaeologist in Pennsylvania to get an archaeology site approved that contained both material evidence, artifacts, and Lenape iconic religious features considered to be a sacred site by the Lenape in Monroe County. So, Ed Henning, welcome to our microphones here at WDIY. This is your maiden voyage. And it's a pleasure to have you because of this. I had never thought about the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in terms of the Lehigh Valley. It was always worldwide. So take us down the path a little bit. Why would people settle in the Lehigh Valley in the first place?
Good question, John. They settled because we had valuable geologic resources found here, especially rivers, Delaware River, Lehigh River, used for transportation. And water was also needed for manufacturing. People forget, they think it's just for drinking or boating, but you need it for manufacturing, especially in the iron industry. Forests for lumber, which was very important for building. Later on, we started sending down to cities like Philadelphia and New York, starting up in the northern area of Pennsylvania, and they'd stop at Easton, and they would send these logs down.
This would be by river?
River, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very dangerous job. Very dangerous, especially when they got to Foul Rift, which is on the Delaware River. And there's still hooks in there for when they connected their mules to try to pull it, these things up the rapids. And you can still see them. They're visible.
They're going against the flow of the river.
Right, to go back up to get the, And this got worse because of they wanted to send machinery up there as the coal industry developed. So, it got to be tough. But let's start with a key that, and I don't want to bring this up again because we talked about the Smithsonian, but the two little stones that started the Industrial Revolution is every new nation needs iron. They need iron to build, and we can go nowhere without iron to chop trees, to make tools, to garden, to manufacture. So the key there was, of course, iron ore. That's the key. That's the key. The other resources, I call them the big four, are important, like the limestone. It's actually called the Jacksonburg Formation. What made that so valuable is the fact that it was absolutely pure. There was no additives. So our Pennsylvania Dutch farmers realized this. And if you drive around the roads today, you see little ovens all over the place. Mm. They are lime kilns. And that's what the farmer did in his off season, is he would burn the lime, use it for a fertilizer, use it for whitewash, and then use it for a slurry for cement. That was picked up later on with many, many of our concrete people in the area, starting from Belvedere, New Jersey, and running all the way out to Copley. That is where this belt, this rare belt of limestone.
That's called the limestone belt?
Yes, yes. Okay. And also, of course, slate. Northampton and Lehigh County had the highest amount of slate in the United States. And originally it was important because of roofing and so forth and so on. However, the problem with that industry as it progressed was only really about 10% of the slate they mined was any good to make into roofing or tools or things of that nature.
Because the pieces had to be large enough.
Large enough and not split or break. See, it's nothing more than, it took 44 million years for it to turn from shale to slate.
44 million years?
44 million, give or take a million or so.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course,
nowadays, with the slate, how do we see it? We see it in little artifacts like coasters.
Yes.
And I think they're very attractive.
If you go down south, you can see where most of our slate goes, in quoite boards. With rubber quoits.
Oh. Now, when you say down south,
well, when like if my best friend's son is a doctor down there, he took his slate.
He's talking southern United States.
Southern United States, oh. And they play quoits. They love quoits. Oh, down there, it was always horseshoes.
Okay,
but that's the kind of stuff that that they do. But
and slate roofs, you see them around the Lehigh Valley,
yeah.
But very expensive.
Huh? Oh yeah. Yeah.
So when the repairs are necessary, that's a that's a problem.
And it's also getting hard for the people to learn the trade. A lot of these things we talk about were. I'm interested in a cause as opposed to effect. You and I had talked about this, and the reason is. We see a lot of beautiful things in museums, and even over at the steel stacks, they've done a pretty good job over there. But those two little stones started it in 1868, Northampton, and the Bethlehem Iron Works came together and became the Bethlehem Steel, second largest in the United States. One of the saddest presentations I make is I worked there for 20-some years in accounting, and when they blew up the BOF, that to me was the end of the giant.
What is BOF?
Basic oxygen furnace. That was the latest, most modern. Growth in started with bloomeries. And what a bloomery is, it's a little furnace that they built, and it was charged with, first of all, wood, later charcoal, and finally coal, because they had no way to get iron. So what came out was called a wrought iron. It was just a glob. And then it was reheated at a forge and turned into the things that they needed for that particular farm or industry or whatever the case might be. Garden tools, axes, you name it. You know, they had to build a home first.
Describe to us a bloomery, what it looks like, how big it is.
It looks like a large beehive with a hole in it and two little, they're called tweers. They're little round holes that you stuck in to fan to get it hot. It was usually mom's job or the kid's job because the hotter it got, the more wrought it would get. And then, of course, they would use this and hammer. You had to keep hammering to get to the wrought iron. Sometimes you'd have to throw it back in and reheat it and start over again. But it worked. Our ore here was eventually replaced from other places, obviously. But it contained about 45 to 48% iron oxide. So that's pretty good. You can, if you have that, you know, and a lot of these smaller countries that we supported here in the United States, what they did was turn around and beat us up by selling, making iron, tool steel, and everything else. But guess what? Put us out of business. That's what it amounts to, you know.
We're on Lehigh Valley Discourse, folks. This is WDIY. It's John Pierce here, your host. And my guest this evening, Ed Henning, is telling us about early industrial revolution in the Lehigh Valley, and particularly about the minerals we were here. Ed, you've mentioned iron ore. You've mentioned limestone, slate. There's one left.
And that's the big one.
All right.
The industry was growing faster than we could supply the necessary wood, charcoal. Wood was going, as I said, down to little cities called Philadelphia and New York to build. So somebody had to step up, and the genius that did that was Josiah White. The problem with coal originally was, first of all, it was too expensive. And second of all, which timely, when you needed coal, you needed it. If you had a furnace going and you didn't have coal, guess what? You were in trouble. So he was not only, I admire the man for the simple reason is that he went up to the coal regions first. And he took his engineer up with him. His name was White, too, but they weren't related.
That's Canvas confusing.
White. Canvas White.
What years are we talking about?
Oh, boy.
19th century.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
But he was as much a scientist as he was an engineer. And he found out that this fossil fuel was the best fossil fuel that he has ever seen and ended up to be the best in the world. It was pure carbon. It did not burn with a flame. It was sustainable. And if he could get it to where he wanted to go, it would solve all the problems in the world. So what he did was he started the Lehigh Coal and Navigation Company. And the job was to build a lock system. So he had a mathematician work with him. And there were 47 locks alone between Machunk and Easton.
Wow.
Now, for those that don't know what a lock system does, you open locks based upon altitude. You either go up or you go down, but it's all based on doors that keep opening and shutting in order to let boats through.
This is either on a river or on a canal.
Right. In this case, it was the canal. The river probably wouldn't work too well for the simple reason is it would be tough to go through a place like a Foul Rift or somewhere like that. The other thing is we were primarily after a fuel, and time was getting short. He solved this problem in a number of ways. First of all, he designed it.
This is Josiah White.
Josiah White. Then he got his chief engineer out, and they set everything up. And while they were doing this, it was a very dangerous job because you needed heavy equipment, you needed dynamite to get to the coal. Then the coal was even worse from a danger standpoint because over 300 people died in 1 year in accidents because of gas. They did not realize the coal gas would explode.
And they're underground. They're
underground,
in coal mines.
Right. So they passed the law then that you could not have a light, you know, any kind of an open flame. And then they switched to lanterns and, you know, battery type. The railroads that were used to carry the building materials, construction materials, were ideal to keep building so that they would have timely delivery back when it hit the canal. So if you and I had a home and we wanted to buy a ton of coal, we wouldn't have to go 200 miles to do it. We could go right down here to the railroad and pick it up. So that was a big saving. Of course, by doing it this way, it was also a big saving because of the money expended to get it done. It was quite an event, and the sad part about the whole thing is Josiah White never lived long enough to see the glory days. He had written in his diary that his health was declining very fast because of all the responsibility he had.
Ed, I hate to have to take a break on a sad note, talking about Josiah White's last years, but we must do that right now on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
My guest on Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening is Edward Henning, who, let's see, we describe as archaeologist, geologist, mineralogist, and paleontologist. And Ed and his friends might say, among other things, but we are learning a lot this evening about the early industrial revolution in the Lehigh Valley. Ed, you were talking about coal, and sometimes it's called King Coal. And what kind of coal was there in eastern Pennsylvania?
Anthracite.
All right. And that's different from other kinds of coal. How?
First of all, it started in peat bogs millions of years ago. And then again, it got hard. The nickname was Black Diamond because it's pure carbon. And it, like I said, as a fuel. Now, the only time I know of up here that we ever used soft coal was in Bethlehem Steel to make a flux. Soft coal does not burn as good. It's more of a flux than it was, in my opinion, than a hard coal.
So does softer coal come from western Pennsylvania?
No.
In part?
No.
No.
No, only south that I know of. That's why we had so much in the way of not only sales here. People sometimes forget that we shipped coal once the canal was finished from Easton through Jersey and through New York down to the Atlantic Ocean. And that's where we started shipping it as a international product because of its good burning qualities.
So it would be shipped abroad.
Oh, it would be shipped abroad.
Wow.
And Glendon Iron Works, on the other hand, they were a company that was headquartered in Massachusetts. So anything they made in the way of pigs that they would turn into forged items, we would have to ship it down and up the Atlantic coast to Massachusetts.
What is an iron pig? I think baseball fans need to know this, Ed.
That is, earlier I said it was wrought, which means it was in its purest form as iron. And it looked, they just named it a pig. It looked like a square. Some of them were square, just piled up on top of each other. Some of them looked, you brought up baseball, some of them looked like a little baseball bat because they didn't bother to put them in a mold. They just rolled them right out. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's the key there was the product. You had to get it quick. You needed to make, there was machinery that needed to be made, and then, of course, you had the air railroads, and it was quite an interesting time to live.
Yes, many, many jobs for many people.
People.
Too. Ed, you're talking about coal. Let's talk a little bit about mining techniques.
Okay. That, simply put, I have never incurred a mine that was considered by definition to be a mine in our area. The only mines that I know are coal mines, where you actually dig it, support it, have air holes in. Everything we got out of here was open pit mining, especially the iron. Now, you could, we, back in those days, John, they had a trouble defining geology. Even the geologists had trouble. For example, if you had a mine, iron mine up in Morgan's Hill, you called it a mountain ore. If you had the same ore down in my house, you'd call it a valley ore. It was the same thing. But I guess they wanted bragging rights at the local tavern about who could supply the best iron. And what they do is it was actually when they started digging, like up in there were 84 leased mines by in Morgan's Hill used by Glendon Ironworks. They even had a little tramway that came down. But when they first came here, they would have carts and they'd start digging where they found a couple pieces of iron ore. And then they dig that out, load it in a cart, take it down. Then, using hit or miss, they would scratch around to try to find another vein or pocket. So there was nothing like today in their mining techniques.
Were they using any kind of machinery to dig, or was it just men with shovels?
Just shovels into a tripod with a bucket.
Wow. And there were 84 such mines?
That was just for Glendon.
Just for Glendon.
Yeah.
South of Easton.
Yeah, and there are mines all over. You can go up on College Hill. You can go up. Let me say a word about, this might be premature, but the Henry Gunworks, and we'll talk about that a little later. He was taught at Christian Springs, moved up. So for the fun of it, I got a map out, an old map, and there were at least 8 mines within 6 miles. So it was very easy to get the ore. They just go down and throw it in a cart and use their mule and take it back and use it. So it was pretty interesting. And you find it all over today, as I said, you know.
So coal mining was underground, was in coal mines that we think of today. And the iron ore was open pit.
All that I have found, and I've had a number of professors in geology working with me, and they say, well, I think I found one. Well, I would go up there and I couldn't find it. So, you know, and of course a lot has happened since then too in their defense. I mean, a lot of building has taken place and so forth and so on. And
We were talking off the air about the huge mall that now sits at the juncture of Route 33 and Freemansburg Avenue,
right,
Bethlehem Township. What was that before?
That was called the Drylands, and that was one of the biggest mines in the area. However, it was never shown because the geologist that wrote it up was not allowed on the land.
Oh my goodness.
It was that big. And he would use it primarily for iron ore as opposed to farming. Remember I said earlier a lot of farmers used it for a cash, but it appears that was so big that he had a direct route on Freemansburg Highway to go to the Bethlehem Iron Mine also, or the Bethlehem Iron Company, the Glendon Iron Company. So he sort of had a monopoly there until winter came, or bad weather came, or mud, or something like that. That's when they had their problems, because today, you know, Freemansburg Highway isn't a very big place. It's still a two-lane road that used to be dirt that connected Easton and Bethlehem.
Interesting. Yeah. And how would he run down the road? Would it be with horses, with mules, carts?
Yes.
Not railroad.
No. This was well before railroad. If you remember, John, in the presentation that you and I had down at the Siegel Museum, you saw a couple wooden carts. That's what they used, okay. You know. Right. And then they'd weigh them, of course, when they went across the bridge.
Well, now that big grassy area that you described, this dry land, has turned into this big mall, do you suppose there's still minerals under there that just were never excavated?
Oh, yeah.
And nobody cares today.
Right across there across from the mall is now owned by St. Luke's Hospital.
Correct.
And if you look there, you see big mounds. And I guarantee you, if you and I would walk there now, about 5 out of every 6 stones that we kicked would have limonite or gothite in it.
Oh. Yeah. So it's still there.
Yeah.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Edward Henning. And he has done much work in archaeology, geology, mineralogy. And Ed is telling us about the Lehigh Valley, what's underneath us that we don't see, and what's been excavated. Ed, you mentioned before we were talking about cement and lime kilns to cement companies, and there were many, many of these cement companies. How many?
I have a list at home. I would say about 35 or 40 around 1900.
And that's Lehigh Valley?
That is the belt. Remember, right. We talked about the limestone belt.
Okay, so
Easton had big ones all the way up. Nazareth has the last one standing with S Rock, which is just, if you go up and through the town of Nazareth, you can't miss it. But it's odd because there's a tunnel under the main route of that they get the limestone out of. People in Nazareth don't even know that they have. They do it the old-fashioned way. Yeah. One thing I would be remiss in, too, John, is we talked very briefly about the pigment industry. There were many side items that we have in our area, geologically and mineralogical, that a lot of places envy very much. For example, mica, which was used in people, our settlers could not afford windows, could not afford glass. So they used mica and called it isinglass. Paint pigment, and I'll go into that a little bit because it's one of the last giants still standing. Paint pigment was the business before the Crayola, when Binney and Smith formed after their dad had given them the business. They went out of the pigment business and went into the crayon business. But the pigment business also started big companies in the area. And if you drive up to Bethlehem yet, you can see the one in Bethlehem because it's all full of red stain from they mined two things called ochre and umber. Ochre was yellow, umber had manganese and was red. Then, of course, they turned it into the paint industry for use in painting, artists, because it was a good grade. They'd found it while they were digging the iron ore out. So they'd separate it, they'd wash it, and then go down to Easton and sell it. I think they got, was it $30 a ton? Something like that. And they sold it on the open market is what it amounted to. But a lot of companies got involved in the pigment. And
that's the story of Binney and Smith.
That's right.
When I was a child going to school and we had the crayons that we worked with our art. Now, this is the 1940s and 50s. I thought that Crayola and crayon were simply synonyms. I did not know that Crayola was a brand of crayon.
Yeah.
That's how important that industry was. And I'm talking back in the Chicago area, not right in the Lehigh Valley where Benny and Smith has been all these years.
Yeah.
So very important that with the pigment.
The other thing about 33% of all the mineral resources come from Chestnut Hill in Easton. That includes some of the rarest types of serpentine, dolomite. And one day, they decided that they were going to find and carve architectural plating for buildings and inside. They found what was called verde antique, which was green and striped with white, verdolite, which was pink, white, red, and regular serpentine, which was a gem, semi-precious gem, called bowenite or williamsite. The people in Philadelphia came up here to look at this and said, it is the finest architecture stone we've ever seen.
No.
And there, I have a picture of a load. Now, in those days, when they sent something down to Philadelphia, this thing was 40-some tons and was going down there. Well, somebody got over to France and England with a piece of this. They said they will buy everything that we mine. It was either France or England or both. And they formed what is called in Easton the Verdolite Company. And I have the original documents from that that shows them. And they said it was the finest architecture stone they've ever seen. Right down in Easton, right on the Williams Quarry Road. And it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And if anybody wants to see it, go down the Easton Post Office. It is all over down there, and it's absolutely gorgeous stuff.
Just on the walls of the post office?
Floors, walls. The stairs, but all of the three. There's the serpentine, the verdolite, the verde antique, and the dolomite had red in it. So you had virtually all these different colors.
I've been in there how many times in that post office? Never knew about all this.
It's beautiful.
Wonderful.
It's beautiful. Yeah. So anyway, I wanted to throw that in because we are mineral rich also. We also have a radioactive, and that's what caused our radon problem in our area, called thorionite, which is a contributor. It's only found in two places in the world, and one is at the Williams Quarry, and the other is in Russia, in granules in the stream. And that's very rare, the thorionite.
Ed, it's time for us to take another break. Here on Lehigh Valley Discourse, WDIY, we are Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm John Pierce. Doing our board work this evening is our Director of Operations, Neil Heaver. We will be back in just a moment.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
The origins of the Industrial Revolution in the Lehigh Valley is our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. My guest, Ed Henning, has studied for years all the different minerals in the underneath us here in the Lehigh Valley and how they were extracted, the importance of iron ore, coal, What are the other two, Ed? The ochre?
Umber.
The umber.
Ochre and umber.
And limestone.
Limestone. Those you got
the,
them all.
Those are the important ones.
The big four.
Want to remember. The big four. So Ed Henning wants to talk to us a little bit about the importance of railroads with all this mining going on.
The first thing that, of course, railroads were used for construction to deliver, particularly not just coal, but all kinds of products. And it was fast and convenient. The problem many times was to get it where it's supposed to be. And railroads today, we sort of live without them, but they were very effective in having stops for to drop off coal that you could go to your house. We talked about this briefly too, and if you needed something for building, it was certainly easier. And the railroads were needed particularly as our industry grew, such as like Bethlehem Steel. You had narrow gauge, which was in plant, but then you had the Philadelphia, Bethlehem, New England Railroad that shipped products. So you had it two ways. You had it by railroads, and then you had it by trucks. But again, the railroads were... Bethlehem Steel was going a long distance with it, because down in Sparrows Point you had an area in Williamsport, you had the wire rope area. They all sort of specialized in different things, so the railroads became very important, and in town too, not just out of town. And you needed to get things quickly if not, time was money.
And the railroads could support great loads also.
Great loads.
Tons. Like
at Bethlehem Steel, I remember nuclear turbines and big pieces. You get one on a railroad car, and that's all you could get on. You had a hard time getting it on, too. Well, you needed cranes and so forth and so on.
And then the railroads came in before we had reliable roads for trucks to travel on.
That's very true, very true.
Nowadays we see more truck traffic, don't we, for products than rail traffic.
Railroads, yeah, and I don't know why. I think there's a place for railroads yet, but that's just my opinion. I guess I'm old-fashioned.
There are many buffs out there who just love railroads, and they have their conventions and streetcars and all those kinds of things that where they had to lay tracks.
Sometimes when we sit out back, every once in a while I'll hear a train whistle in the distance, and there, we still have a few trains, and when I get a chance, I like to look at them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the trains were so important in the development of Europe and European countries, and still are.
Yeah.
People travel frequently by train, whereas we don't in this country. Our distances are longer, so we tend to use airplanes more than trains for long-distance travel. But the importance of railroads cannot be understated, overstated.
I think of... it was sort of a nice time in our history when you'd get on a train and you'd have the berths and the dining room tables, and sort of a nice way to travel. A little slower today. We live a faster,
that's
faster
right.
life.
I grew up in the Chicago area, and there was a railroad. I don't know the name of the railroad, but the train was called the City of New Orleans. There was a song written about it later on. But as a child, I remember going with my brother and my mother, sometimes only with my brother, on that train down as far as Mississippi, where we had relatives staying. And it was very much fun to sit there and watch the countryside go by and then walk into the dining car. It was a special treat for children to do that. And my mother would explain, the man who's standing at the end of the dining car is called a steward. and he directs the waiters, and yeah, time's gone by.
Yeah, time's gone by. We did it out west. My son lives out west, and we took a train just for a ride up in the mountain, and it was the old-fashioned type, you know, the puffer belly, and it was fun. It was fun. Yeah. You know.
So those are railroads that we've talked about. We also want to talk about a trade school called Christian Spring. Ed, what was that about?
There were a lot of jobs and trades needed to be done when our ancestors came over here, because everything virtually was done by hand or with an animal. So the Count von Zinzendorf, in his castle in Dresden, decided to unite all the Moravians in a place called Pennsylvania. And he called it Christian Spring later on. I can't even pronounce the first name that he used because of his one son named Christian, and Spring was Andrance Spring, named after the master gunmaker who taught Henry II how to build rifles. In order to attend Christian Springs, now I bring this in because this is actually a sidebar on trades needed for us to get going with the Industrial Revolution. We are talking about all trades. What happened at Christian Spring was they had a trade school for boys between the age of 15 and 18. You graduated at 18 and had to go out and support whatever trade was needed, and where it was needed, you found a job. They picked expert instructors, regardless of race, creed, or color. For example, archaeology evidence that Kirk Burley and I found indicates that the Indians lived on site and taught the white man gardening, mainly corn, beans, squash, and our Native Americans eventually grew potatoes, tomatoes. Those were all Native American. We don't get tomatoes from Italy. We got them from here. And potatoes not from Ireland, but right from here. Yeah. Anyway, the animal husbandry professor, or teachers as they might be, was from Africa, because there they raised the cattle. They knew what kind of feed, how to milk, how to do everything with the, not just cattle, but pigs and sheep.
So these were black men.
They were black men, African American, but free men. They were treated like any other instructor. And that's what they handled. And, of course, the manufacturing side came from Europe, where you taught. It was an interesting day. You would get up and go to church. Then you would go out and you would sing while you worked. And if you were lucky enough on a particular day, you had a trombone choir, duet, actually, coming from the woods so that you could work. Then at night, of course, you went back, and you went to church again.
I assume these are weekdays, not a Sunday. Probably no work on Sundays?
That I don't know.
Okay.
That I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's a good question, but that mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. The an interesting thing about it, too, was they were very strict. Very, very strict as a church unit. For example, if you missed attendance at a church call, or you were found in the dormitory when you shouldn't be there, or doing something else that was against what they consider the church, you were called on the carpet for it. And Later on, there were sisters also that was taught. I often wondered why until I did some research. What did they do with the women? Well, normally those skills are learned mother and daughter. But they did have a home for the sisters, too, obviously not on campus with the men. Mm-hmm. But it was very big. It grew. Now all that's left is the SROC that I spoke about earlier. It's on their land, and they tore down most of the big buildings. The home is left yet.
Now, where is this?
This is right off of 946 in Nazareth.
So it's in Nazareth.
Yeah. I wouldn't encourage anybody to go there because it is a private property. And they have security up there now, but it certainly was a noble thing.
Called a Christian Spring School, Trade School.
Trade School.
And these were young men, 15 to 18 years old, learning a trade.
Right.
Sounds like the German system of the apprenticeship for several years before you're able to be a master.
Exactly. Craftsman. That's a good analogy, John. Mm-hmm. That's a good analogy. Now, the goods were shipped to market. By the way, there was no tuition to go to the school. You paid nothing. Mm-hmm. And you transported to Bethlehem and Nazareth to the markets all the produce, and it was staggering, the amount. I can't quote you right now. I don't have my paperwork with me. But it was you're talking about thousands of bushels. You're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pounds of food, milk. They did have a spring, so they could serve some of it or save some of it for themselves. But you got to understand that there were a lot of people there, so they had to eat too. So, but then things sort of happened that sort of ruined it all. And to this day, it's a very controversial situation. And what happened was this: we were approaching. This was in Christian Springs was not an overnight thing. It lasted 47 years. But the War of Independence was coming, and so the Pennsylvania General Assembly required everybody in residence to take an oath. Now there was a problem, because they had taken an oath in Europe, and they were considered too radical in Europe for major then-known religions. So they were sort of the black sheep of religions, and now they came over here, and they refused to take an oath. So what happened was 12 of them were arrested and sent to Easton and put on bread and water at the prison. Those that said the oath or took the oath and then went back to the Moravian religion were thrown out of Christian Spring. The instructors were great instructors, but they were not all Moravians. They just left. That was the end of Christian Spring. And it's sort of sad, because to this day, you know, we've always had that tough choice of church and state. And this is a case where, but I think to myself, all that they trained into 50 years were very valuable to the Industrial Revolution. And that's when I threw William Henry II in, because he was taught by Albrecht how to make Pennsylvania long rifles. They were not used as an offensive weapon. They were used as a hunting tool. They weren't made to shoot at people or to do this or to do that. They were made, and they were works of art. Hmm. They have a beautiful museum up there now at the Henry that that if listeners have not been there, it might be worth a trip up to see it.
In Nazareth.
Let's see. It's north of Nazareth at the park.
Okay.
Jacobsburg.
Jacobsburg, yes.
Jacobsburg.
Yes.
Okay. He went back, of course, and using all of his skills, turned out to be one of the finest gunmakers in the world. And to this day, if you want to research him, you can see what a great job he did, because his repeating rifle opened the West.
And this is who did this?
William Henry II.
William Henry II.
Who was a student at Christian Springs. He could put, I think it was 15 44 caliber bullets instead of the enemy firing one. Yeah. With a lever action. And I wonder how many more of those people like Henry II went with us on this Industrial Revolution for iron making and forging and new ways to do things. It's pretty interesting, the results of a seed that was planted back at that time and maybe helped us all more than we think.
Fascinating, yes. The origins of the Industrial Revolution here in the Lehigh Valley. My guest this evening has been Ed Henning, who has delved into archaeology, mineralogy, geology, and his wife hopes into psychology at some point. Ed, is that in your future?
Probably as a patient, but not as not as anybody that knows anything.
Ed Henning, thank great. You so much. It's been a fun interview.
Yes, and you too, John, for inviting me. I really had a good time.
Great. We've talked about iron ore, limestone, slate, ochre and umber, the Big Four, as the Lehigh Valley joined in the Industrial Revolution back in the 19th century. I'm John Pierce. It's been a pleasure to be your host this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thanks to our Director of Operations, Neil Heaver, for engineering for us this evening, and to Ed Henning for coming over and doing his first radio interview here at WDIY. It's our honor, Ed.
Thank you.
And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.